Blog Talk Radio.
Do you think they're really ready for you now? Do you think that there'll be many of you now?
Very, very strange and
enchanted boy. They say he wanders very far over many lands and seas. He was very shy, and there was so much sadness in his eyes. But very wise, so wise was he.
Charismatic and all that. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see by the dawn so proudly we hailed at the twilight land gleaming. Through broad stripes and bright stars, through
you're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. three, four.
I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me wanna shout hallelujah. And I wanna
sing along.
Lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven rain. Ring with the harmony, oh, let it be. Let our rejoice and rise high.
Turn it to
love. Love has your tea.
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our home ownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
For true inspiration, check out singer, songwriter, and radio personality Sylvia Fedrick. Sylvia, your sister under God's construction, brings to you her best in Christian contemporary gospel tunes, and they are available for download at www.sangsyl.com. That's SANGSYL.com. Or you can visit her profile at Chicago Black Business Network. For bookings, call Sassy Michelle at 512-914-4221.
Want to learn the secrets of the wealthy? Do you think that the wealthy sell their gold and silver, or do they buy gold and silver? Learn to create wealth, collect wealth, and preserve wealth for you and future generations. Find out how you can acquire free silver every month. Visit Gold and Silver Plan.
As far back as the 1920s, when he began as FBI director, Hoover had gone after persons like Marcus Garvey. Garvey's organization, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, had a membership numbering in the millions, And somehow, Hoover found this threatening and worthy of surveillance and undermining attempts. Garvey's influence had been international and had drawn world attention to America's treatment of black people. Paul Robeson was another who was viewed by Hoover as an enemy. This reporter has personally examined thousands of FBI, CIA, and other U.S. government agency documents that were kept on Paul Robeson. Robeson, like Garvey, had an international audience at his command, and he used that platform to denounce racism in the United States.
Most importantly, however, were the questions raised by the State Department as to my political opinion. Here's a question of whether one who wants to sing and act can have, as a citizen, political opinion. And in attacking me, they suggested that when I was abroad, I spoke out against injustices to the Negro people in the United States. I certainly did. And the Supreme Court Justice just ruled, Judge Warren, in the segregation cases, that world opinion had a lot to do with that ruling, that our children, Negro children, can go to school like anybody else in the South. I'm very proud to have been a part of directing world opinion to precisely that condition. The second, that I fight for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. Bandung, the colored peoples of the world assembled and made it clear that nobody is going to tell them what to do. They're going to have the independence. I'm proud of that.
When the 60s came, many factions of the civil rights movement had developed the same international perspective.
Those of us living in the United States who see ourselves as, and who are in fact, you know, descendants of the Africans who were brought to this country, who were enslaved, and who are rebelling and revolting now against our oppressive condition, and we are concerned about Africa. We see Africa as our motherland, and we feel that we have a responsibility to speak with as much passion as any other African on this issue. The United States government says that change must come in South Africa through peaceful means. That same government has over 500,000 troops in Vietnam fighting not white people, but brown Vietnamese.
So it is small wonder that the civil rights movement was also subjected to heavy attacks by Hoover. Billions of government dollars were spent in this direction. Many of these activities were not only unwarranted, but of questionable legality. The congressional hearings into the assassination of Dr. King bore this out. Two FBI agents testified before a Senate committee chaired by Senator Frank Church.
I'm trying to find out what it was that impelled some part of the FBI to pursue Martin Luther King with such an obsession. And what I understood that answer to be is, first of all, it was not any suspicions of the commission of a federal crime. None of the literature showed up a single suggestion that Martin Luther King had committed or was about to commit a crime. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes, sir, but at this point, much of what was being done did involve challenges to local laws. And there is a very strong suggestion that King was seen as rallying the lawbreakers and would-be lawbreakers, albeit for a cause that sounded pure. Looking now in terms of, if we look at what might have gotten the Bureau started, and if we remember at the same time he is extremely critical of the Bureau's own law enforcement efforts, we see throughout these documents and the New Left documents that it is taboo to criticize the Bureau and particularly the Director.
Well, was he ever charged with fomenting violence? Did he ever participate in violence? Was it ever alleged that he was about to be violent?
That was the very opposite of his philosophy, Senator.
So that it was neither the fear of commission of a crime or the commission of violence. Was there any serious charge that he himself was a communist?
No such charge ever was made.
So that what was left then was a decision on the part of some persons or person within the FBI that he should nevertheless be pursued.
And replaced.
And the basis for that apparently was political. The decision that he was dangerous or potentially dangerous to someone's notion of what this country should be doing, and a further theory that the FBI possessed the ability to enter into this field and to investigate and to intimidate and seek to neutralize and indeed replace a civil rights leader that they thought to be politically unacceptable. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And the tactics they used apparently had no end. Microphonic surveillance of hotel rooms. They included informants. They included sponsoring of letters signed by phony names to relatives and friends and organizers. They involved even plans to replace him with someone else the FBI was to select as a national civil rights leader. Is that correct?
Yes, that plan didn't get very far.
But it was seriously considered, and Mr. Hoover penned a note to that suggestion commending its authors, did they not?
Yes.
All right. It also included an indirect attempt to persuade the Pope not to see him.
And many other people.
A direct attempt to persuade one of our major universities not to grant him a doctorate degree.
That's correct. After the March on Washington, there was an acceleration. He was defined because of his speech in that demonstration in Washington as the most dangerous and effective leader in the country, and there was a paper battle within the Bureau as to how best to attack him, and he was attacked. After Time magazine named him as Man of the Year, again, the Bureau finds that reprehensible, believes it must attack and destroy. When he was given the Nobel Prize, again, they seek to discredit Dr. King with the persons who welcomed him back from that award. When he began to speak out against the Vietnam War, there's a new crescendo of efforts by the Bureau to discredit and destroy Dr. King.
It is my feeling that the assassination of Dr. King was a part of a conspiracy in the country, and I do believe that some individuals in very high places of our government were involved in this conspiracy. And it is the same conspiracy that eliminated and destroyed President Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and so many other freedom and human rights individuals.
I'm convinced the government was involved at some level. I will never separate the conduct, the attitude of Hoover and the FBI from Dr. King's assassination. I never will do that.
I think one of the most important things that come out in that investigation was that Martin Luther King in Memphis was in a white hotel, and the FBI admitted that they leaked to the press that Dr. King was staying in a white hotel instead of a black hotel, and it was that embarrassment that forced Dr. King to move into the Lorraine Hotel where he was killed.
There are more questions regarding the FBI's role in the assassination of Dr. King. For example, why was Dr. King stripped of his protection just before he was killed in Memphis? Reporter Les Payne and myself interviewed police officer Ed Reddit of the Memphis Police Department, who told how he was mysteriously removed from his security post near Dr. King. However, later, his superior, Chief Holloman, denied doing so.
Why do you feel you were pulled away from your assignment of surveillance that day? Why do you think they pulled you away?
I think because whoever pulled the trigger, I could identify.
When there were complaints from somebody, did we reduce manpower at the Lorraine? Did we reduce manpower in the area?
No.
The attorneys general in 1965 had for 25 years authorized wiretaps in a fairly widespread fashion. This was just one. At the very most, the only thing I can think of that I would have done, but I didn't even do that, was go talk to Bob Kennedy and ask him about it. But Mr. Katzenbach, in whom I also had great confidence,
without giving me the details, said that it was all right, that he had, that there were no, it was not being done anymore, it would not be done anymore, and that there's just nothing to worry about.
I think the issue is the neo-fascist police state mentality that pervaded the intelligence community, that is a danger to America to this day.
Malcolm X was kept under heavy FBI surveillance since he got out of prison back in 1953. As he rose to national prominence as the black Muslims' chief spokesman, he became aware that he was under close watch.
Our desire, our prayer, that we can have a peaceful, intelligent rally here this afternoon. But at the same time, we see that they have surrounded us with many of their own agents in uniform and out of uniform.
That surveillance escalated into the infiltration of the Nation of Islam. Personal frailties were played upon. Jealousy arose. And Malcolm was ultimately ousted from that organization. This caused an intense climate of rivalry that set the stage for Malcolm's assassination in February of 1965.
He was really declared a hypocrite at the time. And because of some of the things that he was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, may God be pleased with him, a strong position was really taken against him. The ministers began to speak out against the things that Malcolm was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Accusations that he had made about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He had accused the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, for instance, of fathering children and et cetera. And you must understand that at that time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to the Muslims then, was held in such high reverence as you would even think of any prophet being held in high reverence. And this is the kind of love and admiration that the Muslims at that time had for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So when Minister Malcolm began to say those things, it was taken as an outright lie. I would say that, take for instance, one time in the Muhammad Speaks at that time, the newspaper printed a big article concerning the chief hypocrite. And it actually had a picture of Malcolm's head, you know, rolling or bouncing down the street at that time. And, you know, the way that picture is depicted, you know, he has little horns on his head and things like this here. So indirectly, I would say that a very, very strong position was taken against him.
Yes, he's immoral. You can't take nine teenage women and seduce them and give them babies and not tell me you're, and then tell me you're moral. You could do it if you admitted you did it and admitted that the babies were yours. I'd shake your hand and call you a man. A good one, too. But any time you seduce teenage girls and make them be charged with adultery, make them hide your crime, why, you're not even a man, much less a divine man. So, and this is what he did. He took at least nine that we know about. And I'm not speculating because he told this to me himself. Yes, that's why he wanted me dead, because he knew that as soon as I woke up, I'd tell it.
Plan of action was basically what took place. Me and Leon, we took seats down in the front of the Audubon, became early. We would drift into the Audubon. If indeed there was a search, then we could never enter. There was no search, so we drifted in just like we had hoped to. Leon Davis and myself took seats down front on the left-hand side. Benjamin and William, who carried the sort of shotgun, sat right behind us, you know. And Wilbur sat somewhat in the back or almost in the middle. And our plan was, as soon as the brother came out to speak, that Wilbur would throw the smoke bomb to make a distraction, and that William would fire his shotgun, and that Leon and myself, we would fire our weapons, and then this break for the door.
And when I enter the room, I bring before you the Minister Malcolm.
And I pray that you and I will listen, hear, and understand. Thank you.
Salaam alaikum.
As in Dr. King's assassination, a police superior has trouble with the truth. He tells reporters that two suspects were arrested at the Audubon. Later, official police reports say that one was arrested. Also, listen closely as the police official carefully handles the question about police on the scene.
We have two suspects in custody now.
Where were they arrested? Who fired the shot?
I wouldn't know that at this time.
Where were they arrested, sir?
One of these men was arrested on the street by one of our patrolmen close by.
There were no police at this meeting, were there, Inspector?
There were no uniformed policemen assigned inside this ballroom.
No uniformed police on the scene. Does this mean that police out of uniform were there? And if so, why didn't they take action? What were they doing there? This behavior pattern rings a bell of striking similarity with the behavior pattern of the CIA overseas.
The church committee produced cables, demanded and got cables, which proved it traced the CIA's plan to kill Lumumba. Sid Gottlieb got on a plane and went to Leopoldville. Headquarters sent a cable saying, use the poison. Gottlieb was couriering for the poison. Headquarters sent a cable saying, you have to use it promptly because it deteriorates. And they had a plan to try and get it into his toothpaste or give it to him in a Mickey at some social function. And then there's a gap, no cables, no explanation of what happened. Then 5 weeks later, he's beaten to death on an airplane. And unfortunately, though, the airplane was in the control of people who had agency cryptonyms. And the gap of what happened has never been answered. The men who were involved and were responsible obviously aren't speaking out, and there's no paper to prove anything.
So perhaps the same tactics were used against the civil rights movement. Heavy infiltration of the ranks, spread the seeds of dissension, then step back and let the blood spill.
As I see it, Mr. Chairman, it is for this committee to be able to figure out how to persuade the people of this country that indeed it did go on. And how shall we ensure that it never happened again? But it will happen repeatedly unless we can bring ourselves to understand and accept that it did go on. And I say that as one who worked as a United States attorney with the Bureau and have enormous respect for its capacities in the field of kidnapping, bank robbery, and a lot of other things, but am appalled to learn what the, if it's correct, the intelligence side of that Bureau was up to for so long.
If we would like to believe that the FBI would do all this viciousness and all of these things to an individual and would stop short of killing him, then we're out of our mind. In America today, if we believe the CIA would deal with foreign assassinations and would not consider it at home, that's like saying the mafia runs crooked gambling tables in South America, but honest ones in America. It just ain't true.
We've seen then how the decade of struggle ended. Many of the prominent figures like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated amidst an intense climate of hatred that government agencies were acutely aware of. In fact, the FBI contributed to creating the climate of hate. Moreover, the assassinations themselves appear to have been facilitated by an elaborate network of government and police agencies who were watching very closely every move that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were making, and then at the same time, they disappeared just as the assassinations occurred. But those were the leaders. What about the students, the troops of the movement? Well, they too were subjected to harassment. This document that you're looking at now shows how the FBI tried to divide factions within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Black Panther Party was also subjected to heavy, heavy surveillance.
We knew the history of the FBI's infiltration tactics in other organizations, particularly the American Communist Party. There was already a record compiled that showed that the FBI was even in charge of various branches of the Communist Party. So we understood that police tactic of infiltration. There was a situation where, in a sense, the white racism was its own victim. Like, for racist reasons, J. Edgar Hoover had not recruited black agents. He had a lot of white agents. And it takes time to train some black agents. In the meantime, those white agents, try as they might, were not able to infiltrate our ranks because the Black Panther Party did not have any white members, okay? And we relied upon people that we knew. And we kept people that we didn't know on another level. And I think this is why we didn't suffer more that way, because they did catch up and start a crash program of recruiting black agents, and they very quickly filled that gap, but it took them about a year to do it.
In the summer of 1978, I interviewed a man who worked as an informer for the FBI during the 1960s. His name is Dothard Perry, also known as Ed Riggs, also known as Bill Perry, also known as Othello.
How were you paid?
The pay was always in cash. Cash, and you would sign a card. It would go like this. A rendezvous or a drop-off point would be picked out either by yourself or the agent. You would meet the agent there. Usually it would be in a vehicle. You get in the vehicle, he would hand you the money. He would tell you first to count the money. He would tell you the amount while you counted it. If the amount was there, he would then bring out a card. On that card would be for the week of such and such. In other words, the week was dated. So-and-so has been paid the amount of. Then you would sign the card, and then the agent would sign the card. The reason for this is that if all of a sudden the IRS became very interested about where you were getting all this extra money from, you could always tell them to go back to the Bureau, and the Bureau would have your cards on file.
I see. Were there such things as bonuses?
Oh, yes.
What were they paid for?
Bonuses were paid for, suppose while you were meeting with, or you were at a meeting with Bobby Seals, Chulai of the Red Army happened to come to the meeting too, which is something which would be a new development. That's bonus time.
In other words, a hot piece of information.
Hot piece, very hot piece.
Did you ever suffer pangs of conscience?
Quite a few times. Quite a few times. I still suffer pangs of conscience. I suffer from the fact that a lot of people trusted me, and I misused that trust. I suffer from the fact that a lot of information that I gave out was the undoing of certain groups or certain people. I suffer from the fact that I'm on the run constantly. I have no real life to speak of.
You have no family life, really? You have a wife?
No, I don't have a wife. I do have a child. I can't see her that often. I have to stay away from them because once I come around, the Bureau shows up. and harassment starts. I have very few close personal friends, no one to really confide in. It's like being on the outside of a glass jar and everything is happening inside the jar, but you're on the outside. You can see it happening, but you can't participate.
Why have you decided to talk to me?
For the simple reason, I think this information should be put out to the public. I think not only black people, but everyone should become aware of what your so-called law enforcement agencies do to so-called enforce the law. Because between you, myself, and the audience, I've seen more felons in law enforcement than I have in prison.
Many would say, well, look, you yourself just got through saying that the DLA was involved in criminal activity. What's wrong with wanting to put them in prison? How would you answer them?
I would answer them this way. First off, we have to understand why they did what they did. But I'm not even going to go off into that psychological hoo-ha. What I'm going to say is when you become just as bad as the people that you go after, then there's nothing gained and a whole lot lost.
You also were active in the infiltration of many cultural groups. Before we go into that step by step, how much research and study did the FBI engage in of black culture in the late 60s?
A great amount.
Give me an idea.
From the thing is, they have a file on every type of magazine that blacks read. They have a file on the music.
Music?
Music, dance, theater, actors, comedians, you name it, man.
And they would actually study these different...
Oh, yes, definitely.
What would they do with music?
To understand the people, you have to understand the culture. To infiltrate, you have to understand. You had a lot of so-called white liberals that were infiltrating the so-called black groups using the information that they had gathered from the studies of blacks.
You mean just to understand the behavior pattern of our people?
Oh, yeah. I can, Will Heaton could name out some jams of Miles Davis that I hadn't even heard of. He could name off some books that I hadn't even read pertaining to black culture.
Do you ever see agents actually studying music of...
Yes, yes. Yes, I've seen them going over even video portion of cultural events. The understanding, like when... Okay, you have an organization like Leroy Jones Black House. You remember that. Okay, Leroy Jones's place, which was done on the thing of tribalism. That's where I first heard the word Kintu, Mantu, Huntu, Hintu. These words of the African continuum. I learned that from an agent. He ran it down to me. They make in-depth studies of the personalities of the people they're dealing with too. Culturally, it always helps when you. It's the thing of. You can take their culture and use it against them.
How large would you say an extensive a collection on our culture would you say the FBI has? Would you rate it as large as a particular library, like the Schomburg Library in Harlem? Or...
I would rate it better. I would rate it better, and the fact is that they go into details that we probably would overlook. Will Heaton used to meet me in different places. You know, Will Heaton, that was one of my supervising agents. There is a certain bar in the Los Angeles area where people into black cultural things meant. And Will Heaton used to meet me there. And he would go into very long and tiring conversations with some very articulate brothers about culture, African culture, and Afro-American culture.
Tell me about some of the cultural organizations that you infiltrated and what you did.
PATHLA, Mafunde, Watts Writers Workshop, which they had.
Watts Writers Workshop?
Yes. Watts Writers Workshop, which was one of the oldest established black writers' workshop.
That place was burned down.
Yeah. The Bureau had it burnt down.
How do you know that?
I know because I participated. I did the arson.
You burned down the Watts Writers'
Workshop? Yes.
Why did they want it to go?
At the time, funding had been cut to the workshop, had been cut out, but it looked like there was a possibility of a grant being given back to the workshop. And if there was no theater, there would be no grant.
How did you do it?
Two cans of kerosene, a Purex bottle, gasoline, and a flare, highway flare.
Why didn't you use more sophisticated stuff?
Oh, no. No. You're never overly sophisticated. It's too obvious. This way you make it look like, you know, maybe somebody in the neighborhood that got kicked out of theater at one time got mad and came and burned the damn theater up, that kind of thing.
But you were involved in this theater? I mean, didn't it get to you at all what you were...
Hey, man, that got to me a great deal. I love that theater. I built the stage.
You built the stage?
Oh, yeah. When I got to the workshop, the stage that had been... The original stage that had been built needed an extension on it. The original part of the stage was in terrible condition. They had no lighting system. I put the lighting system in myself. I put the stage in myself. And that was a stage, man. And that was a theater. It's a nice theater.
Who was the director of that workshop?
Harry Dolan.
Harry Dolan. Some very, very well-known artists supported that workshop, gave money to it.
Some very well-known artists came out of the Watts Writers Workshop. You know, Glenn Tubman, Yaphet Kotto, Sidney Poitier used to come down there and give a class. Sammy Davis Jr. used to come down there all the time. Quincy Jones used to come there and give music classes. We had our own 8-track studio set up for sound. We had our own sound room there.
Was part of your other activities and responsibilities to study the profiles of celebrities who were supportive of organizations?
Definitely, and especially, like I said, psychological backgrounds, weaknesses and strengths. Did he have a weakness for blondes? Did he have a weakness for money? Did he snort cocaine? Did he smoke marijuana? They even get into, oh, and that's one thing the Bureau loves is their sexual background. They have files and files on different blacks, not only celebrities, but a lot of others, sexual activity.
What would they do with this information?
Oh, that's used as a weakness.
So they would feed these weaknesses?
Yes.
Did you see that happen?
Oh, yes. Doc Holliday, who is one of the leaders of the BGF, Black Gorilla Family, which is a prison gang in the California state prison system. Upon his release from prison, a certain sister made herself known to him at a nightclub, whereupon he moved in with her, and she picked up names, telephone numbers, information, you know, that kind of thing. That lasted for a good 3.5 months.
Was this an unusual thing, or did this happen often?
No, that happens all the time.
Did you yourself get involved in doing that?
Yes.
Give me an example.
There was a gentleman that was on trial in Los Angeles that belonged to the BLA that had been busted in a southern state for a bank robbery, but was brought with two other people to Los Angeles to stand trial for the machine gunning of a police officer in Los Angeles. I was supposed to worm my way into the affections of his sister and whatever it took to get the information that I needed as far as what kind of defense they planned to use as to turn this information over to the federal prosecution.
Did you do it?
I got the information, and thank God I didn't have to go through with the actual thing of sexual activity.
What do you mean, thank God?
The sister was rather unappealing.
How did you justify to the organizations in which you had infiltrated yourself that you were living on an $800 a week stipend or on an $800 a week standard of living when most of them were living hand to mouth?
Well, hey, brother, you know, I'm hustling, you know. I mean, hey, man, you know, sell a little of this on the side, a little of that on the side. You know, I get over, you know, that kind of thing. In other words, ain't nobody's business but mine where I get the money. So, you know, everybody took it for granted that I was possibly doing a little dealing on the side, that kind of thing. Then also, everybody liked me for the simple reason that I would do things that I didn't have to do. I would go out of my way. You know, like Mafunde would have a pageant and they needed someone to do the sound setup for him, and I'd say, of course, I'll do it for you, you know, that kind of thing. I was very well liked at one time in the community.
Would you say to American citizens that this situation of surveillance and infiltration continues to this day?
Oh, yes.
On the dimension that you experienced?
Probably much larger by now.
Larger?
Oh, yeah. Let me put it to you like this. Each year, everything gradually escalated up more and more. So I figure when I left, it didn't stop escalating. As they say, one monkey does not stop anybody's show.
You mentioned Sammy Davis Jr., who at one time, it was reported, gave money to the Black Panther Party, I believe. Were you ever assigned to look into that?
Yes, I was told to try to get as close to Mr. Davis or to anyone in his office as I could. I used to go up and have real chit-chat, chummy-chummy conversation with his personal secretary, Ann, at the 9000 building on Sunset. And I used to bring a Porter-Pack video camera, and I used to go around and I would videotape the whole office.
You mean celebrities would be coming into his office and you'd film them freely?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't they question that?
I'm from the Ross Writers Workshop. Yeah, right on, brother, you know, that kind of thing. No questions asked. Same thing with the NAACP Image Awards. You know, they were very interested in people like Sammy Davis Jr. There was another black in Los Angeles that they were very interested in because, not Los Angeles, but in Sacramento, Nathaniel Colley, who's attorney for the NAACP. And I know Nat. And they wanted information on him just for the simple reason that he's an attorney for the NAACP, which makes no sense to me, but must make a lot of sense to them because they use the information.
You've been called upon to testify in Washington. Before who?
Before the Senate Committee. I was called first to testify before the Church Committee, and I did go to Washington, D.C. I did testify to those people, and I want to say right now that the committee was full of smack. They got loads and loads of information and didn't even use it, didn't release it. I had tapes that I offered to them in evidence against the Federal Bureau of Investigation with conversations of me and my supervising officer where he's telling me to obtain certain articles for him by stealing. Don't get fingerprints on it. We can really use that. Did you take the weapons over to such and such? The church's committee told me that they couldn't use the tapes because the tapes were gotten by illegal means.
What would you say about the composition of the committee panel that questioned you?
I can say that for the birds, too, because the same people that I was talking about were the same people on the panel with the church's committee.
What do you mean?
When I came in the room to be interviewed by the so-called people from the church's committee, the representatives from the Federal Bureau of Investigations were also in the room.
FBI agents were a member of the church committee panel?
They were there with the investigators for the church's committee asking questions just like the church's committee. And see, this is another thing that I find fault with, and this is another reason why I am not going to Washington, D.C., is that, again, I have been asked to come again for the second time. I'm not going again for the simple reason that when I went up there, with the idea that there were agencies investigating the Federal Bureau of Investigation, not the Federal Bureau of Investigation investigating itself.
You're on the lam, almost. Do you have a sense that you're going to be arrested and go to prison?
Oh, yeah, eventually. Eventually, when things come to a head, it has to. It has to be that way. No other way around it.
What would you say to citizens who sit and listen to what you've said and have a sense of frustration and helplessness?
There are some agents, the old line agents, that disagree with the tactics that were used during the so-called COINTEL period. But one thing I don't want us to jump off of is that people always talk about, they're talking about COINTEL now so heavily. I'm not talking about COINTEL. I'm talking about a thing called BD, which was better known as Black Death. The Black Death was set up for a simple thing of infiltrating black organizations and black groups, whatever.
Where was this Black Death, or were there a number of them?
There were a number of Black Deaths, but the head Black Death was in Washington, D.C., controlled by Sullivan. And the...
Was he black?
No.
Mm-hmm. And what was the function of the Black Desks all over the country? I guess there were dozens.
The function of the Black Desk was to monitor activity, social unrest, revolutionary groups, cultural groups, and such in the black community.
And feed it into this central desk. And it still exists?
As far as I know, yes.
We've seen a number of investigations into the assassination of Martin Luther King. We've seen an extended police trial of the assassination of Malcolm X. What you seem to say substantiates what many black people say out on the street, that government agents or agencies knew that these assassinations were brewing and either participated in them or allowed them to take place.
It would behoove black people, it would behoove all people, really, to question so-called the cut-and-dry one lone assassin theory. The Bureau and other intelligence agencies are very good at conspiracies. They are very good at setting people up to be killed. They are very good at making innuendos so the person will be killed.
City police don't know about it because they have policemen in there. They don't let black people form anything without some policemen in there. And while I was in the black Muslim movement, over the black Muslim movement, many of the police who were sent to infiltrate us, they're black, would tell me, say, look, I'm a cop, but I have to come. They would tell me. I knew the Muslim movement was full of police. So don't you think anything is going down that they don't know about? The only thing that goes down is what they want to go down. And what they don't want to go down, they don't let it go down.
Something else was used against the students. They drove the final nails into the coffin, killing the movement.
What stopped it, of course, almost dead in its tracks, and not by any accident, was a widespread and deliberately organized. He deliberately organized widespread use of drugs. The fact that a decision was made, and I think you, most of you familiar with the broadcast of the mafia defector who went on public media to declare what happened and outline in great detail the great plan of how to destroy the black youth of the nation, starting in New York. He said in a meeting 20 miles outside of New York City, the great decision was made. He said he didn't have to guess about it, and I those who heard him know that I'm quoting him almost verbatim, because he was there. And the decision was to concentrate the distribution of drugs on the black youth of the nation, starting in New York. Starting in New York, beginning in the elementary school, and that to punish, even on the pain of death, any of the distributors who invaded the white community or predominantly white schools. That New York and other large cities were to be divided up into districts. The district commander, black, was to be given any kind of car he wanted, Mercedes, Rolls Royce, anything, because this would be a part of the sales pitch. Said blacks just love fine cars, and he'd drive around through the community in his fine car, and some of his key assistants, and he'd be identified, he'd be known, and that sort of stuff. And so the story is, I'm not going any further into it. But thus it began, and the spread over the country. And we fell for it. Now, one thing was important. That the thing to attract the blacks, more than any other thing, more than the drug itself, but to spread the word, have a number of key young people in it, and spread the word that this is the end thing. So that'll get them. Just say it's the end thing. And they'll brave the fires of hell to be a part of the end thing.
So that's our story of the decade of struggle. We put together this film to pay particular homage and tribute to the extraordinary young people of that era. And we give the story to our young people of today in particular, in the hope that they'll stop and think about much of the negativism that they're caught up in nowadays and try to understand why.
right, people, I'm back. You know, I know I was keeping it groove with Martin Luther King, and y'all might have heard the FBI conspiracy theory tape I played before, but I was in the middle of a meeting. Standing ovation. They gave me standing ovation. They really, really loved Jimmy Lee. Oh, my goodness. I was so frantic. Oh, Lord, the people gave. I had a speech today. I didn't even think I was speeching, but let me get back with this quick break because I was gone for a whole hour, and I hope y'all enjoyed that little tape, and I just got so much to tell y'all, so much to tell y'all. But, again, allow Jimmy Lee to show you the way.
Let me show you the way to go.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you. We're going to get on top of the world, everybody. Just let Jimmy Lee, let Jimmy Lee, let me show you the way to go. Follow me, Jimmy Lee. What's up, Dana? What's going on? Glad you called in. What's happening?
Hey, Jimmy, how are you?
Well, Dana, I'm in a happy, special place because today I did my first political speech today, which I did not know I was going to do a political speech today, and I knocked the crowd out. You know, it was a mixed crowd, white and Puerto Rican, but everybody was just a freaking good times of rolling. Just like uptown, like Prince said, oh, I couldn't complain. Could not complain. I was in such a good space that my speech went over. Well, I guess if you speak from the heart, dang, I was trying to tape it. I was trying to tape that speech. It was off the chain. I got a standing ovation. Wow, more, more, more. And then they even want me on a speech. I popped up like he's here. Oh, he's here again, everybody. There go Tillman. To the point where, oh, my God, Tillman. We're coming to your Martin Luther King breakfast Sunday at Isola's on 79th and Eberhardt. We're coming to your Martin Luther King breakfast, 12 to 3 o'clock for those in Chicago. Oh, my God. And we're going to come to that meet and greet at Rare's Friday, 656 with DJ Hula. But anyway, off the chain. And I got so many people committed to the Jimmy Lee program. But enough of me, Dan. Enough of me and enough of you. Today is the Reverend Martin Luther King's birthday. Now, the next couple of 40 minutes I got left of my show because I'm just not getting on the station. Dana, why don't you tell my people...
Hey, yeah.
We're going on. Going on.
Wait.
Go on ahead.
So wait a minute. Are you trying to tell me that these people came out for Team Tillman?
Man, if Team Tillman, Jimmy Lee to D.C., standing ovation, we're going to see how they get down. You know, listen, I'm so blessed. Number the Most High is blessing me every day, so I can't complain on that. I'm going to play some gospel in a minute. But listen, my man Martin Luther King, Dana, the great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Morehouse alumni, the man who changed the way America is today. What's your take on him? Not memories, because you weren't really around, but your thoughts on the man and what he meant to America and Black America, Dana.
You know what? He was America wasn't ready for him, obviously, and that's why they took him down. He was a man with a vision that just far surpassed so many others during that time. It's a shame that his life was ended at such a young age, but his impact on this society was monumental. So, you know, I'm thankful that he was born, and I just wish that I had the chance to live during the time that he was alive. But to this day, it has proven that that lessons unlearned are destined to, history unlearned is destined to repeat itself. And we're still trying to fight those same issues and problems that we have been fighting more than 45 years ago. And that's sad.
That is so sad, right? In my speech today, I was like, here we are, 1965, the Voting Rights Act, and y'all not saying nothing. Nobody's saying nothing. Yeah, I mean, oh, my God, then I lit the room up to the point. I even say anything about the party, but my ancestors, oh, my God, I left the spot to the point that they realized blacks, the whites, the Puerto Rican, everybody in the ethnic background, at the end of my speech, they all went to the ethnic corners, which I told them to go to, and they got to think about where they want America to be at. My good Lord, Dana. Dana, I need to stop talking to you sometimes because you put me in these crazy ass. I'm an American. Stop segregating.
You said what?
I'm like, there's segregation in the army. People are going to be discriminated against. I don't know where I came from. I just kept going on and on and on and on and on and on. Here it is, 50 years later, and nothing's changed. Nothing's changed, but wait for my breakfast. And it's funny, Dana. In my speech with that, I'm like, y'all, 8 o'clock, I have a radio show to get on, too. And I left the show. Left the stage. Ah, and applause. I had applause. Wanted more. I had to go. I got mad. I had to go because they wanted more. Wow. So that was my first speech. And I didn't have it written down. I went straight from the hip. Now I need more speech and practice writing out. Now I go out, they're going to want me to do something now. So I need to prepare remarks for it. Now that caught me off guard, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, I thought I was that prepared, but I didn't think they was going to even give me a platform to say A, B, C, D. They did, so I'm satisfied.
I want to bring that pineapple orange.
Yeah, so.
Well, I'm proud of you.
Mm.
I'm sorry, I'm out here getting my son. My son is sick, so I'm trying to take care of my baby.
Well, that's good, that's good, that's good. Do you ever educate your children on Martin Luther King?
Oh, definitely. Of course. Definitely, without a doubt.
It's funny, during the years and time, and I'm not saying King was the Messiah, but he was Christ-like. And what I mean by Christ-like, people, here you have a man, a minister of the Word of God, who took what he believed in God and put it on the line. God told him, put your life on the line and march out over all those people that hate. Nothing's going to happen to you. Bricks, bombing, assassination. You know? And then, like his last speech, so prevalent to King's Last Supper. Good days are coming, everybody. Good times. I might not be there. I'm letting y'all know that now. But trust me on this. I done seen it. God has ripped and showed it to me. Now, we can look at that as prophetic, what happened, but that's prophetic. Now, we have a black president now. We had a black Secretary General Kofi Annan. We had Colin Powell. We had Condoleezza Rice, Clarence Thomas. I mean, Thurgood Marshall. Times did change. But people just didn't. They just watched the change and accepted the change. Then they participated in the change or tried to keep the change moving, you know, or keep the currency of the change energized, you know. And then it's our watch, Dana. What you feel, what you feel, what you see is what you see. You know, we see the top clocks being turned back. It's our time. This is our watch. This is our generation. Shit like this can't be happening a lot of time. People should not be getting discriminated in the Navy. People should not be getting, Trayvon Martin should not get shot because he's walking around being black. I'm just saying, the Voting Rights Act should not get set down. I'm going to go back to the Voting Rights Act war for black rights. There was a set of laws that was made specifically for black people because we were discriminated against, and I would not let them shit go away. Nah, shit ain't right. Nah, those laws need not to be erased because shit is still the same. Problems still the same, Danny. You know what I'm saying? Problems still the same. And that's why it was such good to hear my friend Chuck last night, ladies and gentlemen, Charles Harris, full disclosure, a friend of mine. Went to high school with him, and he's running for office. He ain't going to do the GOP thing, but he's strictly down with Jimmy Lee. You know, he's strictly going to make sure that Jimmy Lee get it going on. So this is what I'm going to do. Hold tight, Dana. And Ebony, give these calls. I'm gonna play one cut because I gotta give props to the Most High because, hey, only the Most High makes things done. And people, I'd like to know what's y'all take on Martin Luther King, you know, not the laws of land, but the man, the myth, that's the myth, the laws of the land, not the, I had a dream, yeah, cool, nothing happened, no, but the braveness of how he put his life on the line. Be right back in 6 minutes, everybody.
I wish I had the time to tell you a story about a man called Shouting John. But I don't have that time tonight. But you gotta realize, if old John was here, after going through, he'd look back at that old mule and said, since I can't shout in your church, since I can't dance in your church, hold my mule. I feel like shouting right now. I come to tell somebody I feel like I'm praising, praising him. Well, help me out, y'all. Oh, I
feel like praising, praising him.
Praising in the morning. Everybody, now we're gonna go back home and sing it like we used to a long time. I'm going to praise the Lord while I have a chance. You know, we didn't have a lot of music. Come, oh, oh, oh.
I'm going to praise the Lord while I have a chance.
I like that. Come on. Praise him in the morning.
Praise him in the morning.
Praise him all day.
Praise him all day long.
Come on, help me. I feel like
he's praying.
Yeah. If you don't want. You've committed unto him a check that day. Now let me hear you say, Jesus.
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 Jesus. Nobody but Jesus.
Jesus.
Nobody but Jesus.
Jesus.
Let me hear you call him.
Jesus.
Let me hear you call him.
Sometimes you got to give up the blessings. Man, Sean, why you leave? Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Yeah, lady going to come up today and say, it's either you believe in the Most High or you don't believe in the Most High. It's all about the Most High, do or die, baby. Do or die, Most High, that's all it's about. I lost my last call. Let me go play some more Kings. I guess people don't want to talk about the great leader, ML. the great emancipator. Let me give some let's talk about Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. How about some King and Malcolm X? Y'all like to see some of that stuff because people, man, we got to love hip-hop. King, Paul King, this King, that, even Martin Luther King's, but okay. Here's Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. Let me know what y'all think about this.
You then attack next the state laws against such an American?
Well, I haven't planned a particular attack on that, but I don't think America will ever come to its full maturity until every state does away with laws prohibiting individuals to marry on the basis of race. But I think basically this is an irrational fear because it is an individual matter. And I think the question here at bottom is a question of illicit miscegenation. And if you will follow the record there, I think you will discover that illicit miscegenation has existed more in the South, where you have had rigid segregation laws, than it has existed in the North, where you don't have such barriers. It hadn't been the Negro who was the aggressor at this point. If we just need to look around and we can see that.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. King, you say that the Negroes have a moral right to occupy the restaurant seat. Now, you've had a Supreme Court edict on the school integration. Would you say that your children, the Negro children, have a right to occupy the seats in classrooms too? And would you consider that form of nonviolence?
Well, I'm sure that Negro...
White man pays Reverend Martin Luther King, subsidizes Reverend Martin Luther King, so that Reverend Martin Luther King can continue to teach the Negroes to be defenseless. That's what you mean by nonviolent. Be defenseless. Be defenseless in the face of one of the most cruel beasts that has ever taken the people into captivity. That's this American white man. And they have proved it throughout the country by the police dogs and the police clubs. 100 years ago, they used to put on a white sheet and use a bloodhound against Negroes. Today, they have taken off the white sheet and put on police uniforms. They've traded in the bloodhound for police dogs, and they're still doing the same thing. And just as Uncle Tom, back during slavery, used to keep the Negroes from resisting the bloodhound or resisting the Ku Klux Klan by teaching them to love their enemy or pray for those who use them despitefully, today Martin Luther King is just a 20th century or modern Uncle Tom or a religious Uncle Tom who is doing the same thing today to keep Negroes defenseless in the face of attack that Uncle Tom did on the plantation to keep those Negroes defenseless in the face of the attack of the Klan in that
Well,
day.
I don't think of love as in this context as emotional bosh. I don't think of it as a weak force, but I think of love as something strong and that organizes itself into powerful direct action. Now, this is what I tried to teach in the struggle in the South, that we are not engaged in a struggle that means we sit down and do nothing. That there's a great deal of difference between non-resistance to evil and non-violent resistance. Non-resistance leaves you in a state of stagnant passivity and deadening complacency, wherein non-violent resistance means that you do resist in a very strong and determined manner. And I think some of the criticisms of non-violence, or some of the critics, fail to realize that we are talking about something very strong, and they confuse non-resistance with non-violence.
The goal of Dr. Martin Luther King is to give Negroes a chance to sit in a segregated restaurant beside the same white man who has brutalized them for 400 years. The goal of Dr. Martin Luther King is to get Negroes to forgive the people who have brutalized them for 400 years by lulling them to sleep and making them forgetting what those whites have done to them. But the masses of black people in America today don't go for what Martin Luther King is putting down. As you said in one of your articles, it's psychologically insecure, something of that sort. I forget how you put it. But you didn't endorse what Martin Luther King was doing yourself.
I do not reject his goals of full integration and full equality rights for American citizens. Do you reject these goals?
If you don't think that he's walking on the right road, I'm quite sure you don't agree that he'll get to the right place. And if you would classify his method as psychologically unrealistic, I think that if a man's method is psychologically unrealistic, which means the road or the means or the method that he's using, I think as a psychologist, you would be very doubtful that he would reach
true.
The right.
If anyone has ever lived with a nonviolent movement in the South, from Montgomery on through the Freedom Rides and through the sit-in movement and the recent Birmingham movement, and see the reactions of many of the extremists and reactionaries in the white community, he wouldn't say that this movement makes, this philosophy makes him comfortable. I think it arouses a sense of shame within him often in many instances. I think it does something to touch the conscience and establish a sense of guilt. Now, so often people respond to guilt by engaging more in the guilt-evoking act in an attempt to drown the sense of guilt. But this approach certainly doesn't make the white man feel comfortable. It disturbs conscience, and it disturbs this sense of contentment.
Nothing will they ever do. They will always talk it, but they won't practice it. And with the Supreme Court, if the NAACP can tell me that they want a desegregation decision for me 10 years ago, but yet the schools haven't been desegregated, as I say, this is a victory with no victory. It's a victory that you can talk about, but it's a victory you can't show me. So if you represent the NAACP and you are telling me about this great victory you won for me, when I look at you, I have to conclude that either you have been duped yourself or else you are trying to dupe me. And in most instances where the civil rights struggle is involved, there is no civil rights leader can point to me one concrete gain, practical gain, that black people have made in the civil rights field in this country, not only during the past 10 years, but during the past 100 years.
I don't think there's any real organization to the riots. I think they grow out of the conditions that I've mentioned all along. And as long as these intolerable conditions are there, as long as the Negro finds himself living every day in a major depression, then every city will sit on a powder keg and can explode over the slightest incident. I feel that killing is a very tragic way to deal with any social problem. There is no violent solution to the problem that the Negro confronts in this country. And this is why I have constantly said that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. After all, the Negro ends up on the losing end. We can't win a violent revolution. Most of the persons killed in riots are Negroes themselves. The persons who end up not being able to get milk for their children are Negroes because things where they have to live are destroyed. So there's no practical or moral answer in the realm of violence to the Negro's problem. But I do understand the sociological, the psychological, and the economic reasons.
The problem can be solved. First, the white man and the black man have to be able to sit down at the same table. The white man has to feel free to speak his mind without hurting the feelings of that Negro. And the so-called Negro has to feel free to speak his mind without hurting the feelings of the white man. Then they can bring the issues that are under the rug out on top of the table and take an intelligent approach to get the problem solved. That's the only way that they'll ever do it. We need an action program while we are Muslims, and while we are Christians, or while we are whatever we are. We still need an action program that will eliminate these evils that are in our community. And this is what we're trying to do with the Muslim Mosque Incorporated.
Do you consider yourself militant?
I consider myself Malcolm.
Well, I think we have to agree that this appears to be the result of an internal conflict within the black nationalist movement. So I think the first thing that needs to be done is for a conference of goodwill to take place between black nationalist leaders. This was why I suggested a few days ago that the followers of the late Malcolm X and the followers of Elijah Muhammad should sit down at the peace table together, so to speak, and discuss this problem and try to reach some understanding. I don't think, and I'm sure, that nothing can be accomplished by violence. It only leads to new and more complex social problems. I think it is unfortunate for the black nationalist movement. I think it is unfortunate for the health of our nation.
Hello, Jesus, Jesus' children, Jesus loves you, Jesus' children. Hello, children, Jesus loves you, of America. Are you hearing what you're saying? Are you feeling what you're praying? Are you healing faith, feeling what you say inside? You said, I'll tell your story back. And if you like it, it will come to pass.
Superman was killed in Dallas. There's no love left in the palace. Someone took the Beatles' lead guitar.
Have another Chevy's Regal. 12 years old and sex is legal. Your parents don't know where or who you are.
Used to be the hero of the ball game. Took the time to shake the loser's hand. Used to be that failure only man. You didn't try. In a world where people gain again.
Great big wars in little places. Look at all those frightened faces. But don't come here, we just don't have the room.
Love thy neighbor's wife and daughter. Cleanse your life with holy water. We don't need to pay. We've got a few.
Used to be a knight in shining armor.
Didn't have to own a shiny car.
Dignity and courage were. Not the drugs he needs to hide the scars. Whoa, 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 whoa. Can you teach your read? Don't you preach or pray? Don't your president have soul? Have you heard a real good ethnic joke today?
Mama took her seat
and Daddy ran away. But you mustn't lose control.
Let's go to class.
I got some grass. The kids are wild. We just can't tame them.
Do we have the right to blame them?
What the hell? They're too young to feel pain.
Oh, but I believe that love can save tomorrow.
Ooh, I believe the truth can make us free. Someone tried to say it, and we nailed him to a cross. It used to be.
Yeah, yeah, that's Stevie Wonder and Sherelle. Used to be. Man, that was a cut when I was coming up. It came out and disappeared. I mean, I've been trying to find years and years and years trying to find that cut. I'm glad somebody sent it to me. But, yeah, just celebrating life and times with my great leader. Because today is his birthday. And, wow. What would the world be like if he was here today? You know, will he be, would he have been the next president? Would they try to put him off in a cabinet or try to give him a TV show? Would they have tried to make him the great evangelical preacher, another Pat Robinson? What would have happened if he still lived today? Will the middle class be disappearing? Will reparations still been had? Will Tulsa, Oklahoma, would they have received their justice from having bombs dropped on them? Will the Voting Rights Act of 65, would that still be in existence? Well, if today is your birthday, could you celebrate with Martin Luther King Jr., this song is for you. And happy birthday to you. It's not the happy birthday to you song, but it's the song for everybody who's Capricorn, definitely in the building, all your Capricorns in the house. This is for you all right here.
Oh, today is your birthday. And I wish you many, many, many more. Oh, today is a special day. One you never had before. I'll send you flowers by the hour. Candy and perfume, I'm gonna shower you. Precious baby, birthday baby, tonight. Oh, today is your birthday. I wish you many, many, many more. Oh, today is a special day. One you never had before. I'll send you flowers by the hour. With candy and perfume, I'm gonna shower you. Pretty baby, birthday baby, tonight.
Happy birthday, happy birthday, a heart full of stuff.
I have the mic on. Tell my daughter who Martin Luther King was, raising my little mother. All right, y'all, this is Jimmy Underground Radio Network. I would like to say good night, everybody, and may your God be with you. Take us out, King. Yes. Yes.
This is Ned Brooks inviting you to Meet the Press.
Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air and winner of every major award in its field, is a public affairs presentation of NBC News.
Our guests today on Meet the Press are the heads of the two major groups participating in the March on Washington this Wednesday, Mr. Roy Wilkins and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Mr. Wilkins is executive secretary of the oldest and largest Negro organization, the NAACP. Dr. King, who is president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, has become a symbol of nonviolence in the civil rights movement. We'll start the questions now with Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Wilkins, there are a great many people, as I'm sure you know, who believe that it'd be impossible to bring more than 100,000 militant Negroes into Washington without incidents and possibly riots. What do you see as the effect on the just cause of the Negro if you do have any incidents, if you do have any rioting?
I don't think there will be any rioting. I don't think 100,000 people just assembling is cause for apprehension about a riot. The city of Washington has accommodated much larger crowds, and nobody has talked up in advance the possibility of violence. But of course, if there should be violence, and we've taken every precaution to see that there is not, it might have an effect on the public's attitude toward the civil rights movement.
Mr. Wilkins, what gains do you think you can make as a result of this march that will outweigh the risks you take? And there are risks you're taking.
We don't regard the risks as being that great, and we think the gains are immeasurable, because we will bring to the capital of the nation, to its proper place, and to the Congress of the United States, the deep concern of millions of Americans over this question, concern which has been shown in the local demonstrations, which has erupted and been shown in city councils and state legislatures, and which needs to be brought to the Congress, because, as you will recall, the Congress passed in 1957 the first civil rights law in 82 years. We think it's time they should pass a lot of laws, and we think the fact that 100,000 people will come here from 50 states to show by their presence that they believe that this legislation should take place is worth whatever small risks are involved.
Don't you think that both the country and Congress itself is aware of the situation? You read the press today, and you read about the demonstrations that have gone on for some time now all over the country. Don't you think they have made Congress aware and the people of the country of the seriousness of this situation? Do you have to take the risks you're going to take in order to emphasize it?
Mr. Spivak, I don't believe the Congress as a whole has been as responsive to this situation as it should have been. A great many congressmen have been sensitive to it, and a great many senators. But there is evidence that they still believe we can do business on the civil rights front in the same old way.
One more question. What are your latest estimates of the crowd that you expect on Wednesday?
Well, I'm contenting myself with saying more than 100,000. I'm unable to say whether it'll be 110,000, 145,000, or 190,000. But I will say it'll be more than 100,000, and I personally tend to be a little conservative.
We ran out of time for Martin Luther King came out. Hey, y'all, see y'all tomorrow. New Music Thursday. Jimmy Lee's, I'm out of here. Jimmy Lee to D.C., everybody. Let's do it.